From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, near-death experiences, the incredible story of Jim Bruton. Wait till you hear that. Here's what's happening. As government officials attempt to handle a near unprecedented pandemic event that has reportedly killed more than 125,000 Americans, citizens are now facing health orders that seem to change by the day as cases in many places in the U.S. surge, placing hospitals under stress and worrying officials who are tasked with keeping their constituents happy. Now, plans for a steady and gradual reopening amid the coronavirus have effectively been scrambled in many states now. Instead, those efforts have been put on hold in places including Texas, Arizona, while other states, including California and Oregon, have mandated face coverings in public. Meanwhile, many local governments are taking measures into their own hands with restrictions like mask requirements, and others are resisting their state's health measures as well. It truly is a mess. Governors in the Northeast, once considered the U.S. epicenter of the coronavirus, are tightening restrictions in their states for travelers from areas of the country now seeing upward trends in positive coronavirus cases and hospitalizations. Ahead of the July 4th weekend, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut have expanded travel advisories requiring people arriving now from 8 additional southern and midwestern states to quarantine there for 14 days. As of Tuesday, the Democratic governors from the tri-state area are requiring self-quarantine for travelers from Alabama, Arkansas, Arizona, California, Florida, Georgia, Iowa, Idaho, Louisiana, Mississippi, North Carolina, Nevada, South Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, and Utah. The requirement was first announced for 8 states last week. And COVID-19 triggers changes apparently in blood platelets, could be a contributing factor to the onset of heart attacks and strokes in some patients with this disease, according to new research. Scientists from the University of Utah found that the inflammatory proteins produced during infection significantly alter the function of platelets, making them hyperactive and more prone to form dangerous blood clots. Take turmeric, folks, and that fights inflammation. Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com with us this year. John, I want your take on this because there's a lot of people who do not believe the statistics we're getting from the government. What are your thoughts on all of this?
Well, whatever statistics we're getting, no matter how much you try to minimize what's going on right now, the risk of human-to-human infection right now, this is an extremely contagious virus. We're seeing a second wave right now, especially in Texas and Florida, in California, in Oklahoma, in several other states. And I think this is extremely bad. And it's just like a nightmare scenario for Trump, basically, because essentially he's being blamed for all of this. Now, in reality, we all know that no Democrat, no one independent could have done any better job in this country. We are not, South Korea, North Korea, it's a communist totalitarian countries, or even Europe for that matter. We're very independent, disobedient type of population in the United States that really doesn't like to follow all the, the guidance given by, health authorities. I mean, if you listen to Anthony Fauci today and you heard the warnings right now of this second wave hitting and the potential closures, I think Governor Newsom tomorrow is going to go ballistic. I think he's going to shut down the Los Angeles area completely. I think the beaches over this holiday weekend, they've already been Ron DeSantis in Miami's already announced that they're being closed. When you've got Greg Abbott in Texas, one of the most liberal of the governors with respect to, following these guidelines, closing down bars and nightclubs. You know what nightclubs are in Texas, the honky-tonks.
Right.
I mean, my God, this is bad right now, George. And I don't know if you heard what Fauci said about a new H1N1 that's brewing in China right now.
I know. It's mutating.
That's mutating. It hasn't yet crossed over, they think, to the human host, but it could be as bad as the 1918 flu they're talking about, something very similar, far worse and more deadly than the H1N1 flu in 2009. If we're hit with this over the winter, of a deadly, swine flu epidemic plus the coronavirus, good luck on this economy right now that is teetering on completely. The wheels have come off, and Wall Street is going to go through a major tailspin if this keeps going.
And still no reports of the seasonal flu, which I think is still mixed in with these 125,000 other deaths they've been reporting. John, thank you. Trials of the anti-malarial drug taken by U.S. President Donald Trump to try to prevent catching coronavirus ought to resume. United Kingdom regulators say hydroxychloroquine and a similar drug, chloroquine, can be given to health workers in a clinical study to test the theory. We will give you the results when we get them. Well-known actor Carl Reiner is dead at the age of 98. His buddy Mel Brooks paid tribute to him, calling him a giant whose contributions to the entertainment industry is unmatched. Reiner, one of the most prolific entertainers in the history of show business, passed away at his home in Beverly Hills with his family at his side. He was a producer, director, actor, a Grammy winner. He won 9 Emmys in over 7 decades. He has more than 400 credits, best known as playing Alan Brady, and he created the Dick Van Dyke program, the Dick Van Dyke Show. Gold futures rising above $1,800 an ounce for the first time in more than 8 years as low interest rates and a resurgence in the coronavirus cases drive demand for the metal as a haven. Let's check in with America's Financial Reckoning Day author, Charles Kompas. Charles, what about the stock market? What's going to happen?
Well, it's interesting. Today marks the end of the second quarter, George, in which we saw a 50% drop in GDP. We've mentioned that. Stock market's had its best quarter since 1998 for the S&P and since 1987 for the Dow. It's 33 years, 20% gain. So it's completely divorced from reality, as we know, that the stock market, it's a casino. Easy credit has provided this through the Fed. And gold and silver is definitely catching a bid. We have gold up this year 26%.
Huge.
Yeah, $1,800 high since, the highest since 2011. And that's in the August futures contract. But we're going to break 1,800. The last high was 1,900, so we're probably going to 2, 3, 4. We have a record high in 70 currencies in gold. People don't realize that because commodities are priced in the U.S. dollar, and the dollar strength is distorting that. But think of that, 70 other currencies. Gold is high, and the demand is up. But we also have silver up 20%. You know, I like silver. It's up 32% in this second quarter.
Jeez.
And think of that. This ratio is 98 to 1, so extremely distorted there. Highly favors silver going forward, very bullish on that. The COMEX New York contracts, silver delivery contracts for late July are 4 times their historical norms. We've been watching this. I just wrote it in my newsletter, potential delivery defaults. If not next month, it could be September. Boy, that's going to be a price explosion, so watch for that. And I'm hearing what your guests are saying about the virus and the second wave and all this. Boy, the states are in terrible shape because they don't know what to do. The economy, the outlook is not very good. BOA says we're facing a fiscal cliff because about 50% are out of the labor force.
Well, and they can't shut down anymore, Charles. They can't open up, shut down. They're going to destroy the economy.
Well, and then, yeah, exactly. And then if they open up, and then there's maybe liability. You know, people could sue them and say, I got the virus, and who knows. And then you have the CARES Act benefits are running out, so they're going to bail that out. And then all these lockdowns. Here in Arizona, I think we have a 30-day mandated lockdown now. I think California, your county, is Orange County being locked down?
Well, I'm in L.A. County, so I'm but they're going to announce tomorrow. The governor's going to announce tomorrow some more restrictions, so I think they're going to tighten up again.
There's going to be no V-shape recovery here, I'm afraid.
I know. It's something. Charles, let me get your website out, chuckkoppes.com, chuckkoppes.com. He's got great information. His book is called America's Financial Reckoning Day. You know, after retiring from his perch atop the American late-night TV ratings, our dear friend Jay Leno, comedian, has more time to partake now in his passions, and that's collecting cars. As a matter of fact, he's got another program on called Jay Leno's Garage, which is on CNBC. As a matter of fact, tomorrow night's episode features Billy Gibbons from ZZ Top, with his 1934 Ford Coupe. And Billy's on the line with us, a fan of our program. Billy, this is cool. How did they find you?
Well, George, that's a good question. I'm thinking about going back before the curtain dropped. Presently, we're sitting out in the desert enjoying listening to Coast to Coast, of course, and in the background is the sound of tumbling dice. But the sound of that 34 Ford engine was cranking up, making loud noise, and as you mentioned, Wednesday night, which is tomorrow, 10 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Pacific time, they're going to pull the trigger and let that good episode with Jay let it fly.
I could swear I remember seeing some scenes of this Ford Coupe in some of your MTV videos. Were they in there?
Yes. This one is fenderless. This is the bad little sister to the famous Red Eliminator. So famous. You can actually get a little preview. Just go on to CNBC.com and type in Jay Leno and Billy Gibbons. They've got a nice little, about a 6-minute teaser in preparation for tomorrow's show. But yes, you're right. This car is soon to make its big splash on the TV screen.
How many classic cars does Reverend Gibbons have?
Well, I had a nice talk with Jay, as you know, the Jay Leno collection is far and wide. He said, he asked me a question. He said, here you are with me and your hot rod buddy, Jimmy Shine. Between the two of you, you got plenty of cars. Which one do you like? And I said, well, Jay, I said, the one that's still running is probably a favorite.
I love it. People are still clamoring to see ZZ Top, Billy, and this coronavirus has affected everybody. Let's pray that next season you guys get going again, huh?
I think that's a good plan. ZZ Top is always ready to get out there and let it rip. All in good time. It seems like we've taken a couple of steps forward. Now we have to take a step back. But I think provided everybody plays by the rules and plays it smart, wear a mask out in public and keep your fingers crossed, and we'll get back to it.
Watch Billy's 1934 Ford Coupe at the CNBC tomorrow night. Up in a moment, Bart Costco back with us on Coast to Coast as we talk about his latest work, Cool Earth, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Dr. Bart Costco back with us, Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering and Law, the University of Southern California, award-winning pioneer and author of machine learning fields of artificial intelligence, neural networks, fuzzy logic, holding degrees in philosophy, economics, mathematics, electrical engineering, and law. Dr. Costco has organized several conferences on machine learning, serves on the editorial boards of several technical journals, holds patents on machine learning as well. A couple of his books include Nanotime, Heaven in a Chip, The Fuzzy Future, and his latest, which just came out, Cool Earth. Bart, welcome back to the program, my friend.
Good to be back, George.
How are you? You getting by this situation we're all in?
I'm getting by fine, George. I'm in the mountains. I haven't been much in L.A. since we largely closed the University of Southern California back in March. I Zoomed all my lectures.
Yeah, good. That works. Technology once again prevails, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And a lot of consequences from that. A lot of people are wondering about what the world will be like when we go back to brick and mortar, or in general, atom to atom versus bit to bit. Why am I driving from one computer screen for an hour to another computer screen? I think there'll be some pretty deep changes as a consequence of this.
Absolutely. Bart, Cool Earth is a novel, but it's based on a lot of things that are happening right now. Tell us a little bit about this.
Cool Earth is a strategy for cooling the Earth if we don't take remedial steps now in the near future to reduce global warming. There's a lot of things we can do. And I would say to your audience, George, if you don't like the lockdown, and nobody does, and you don't like big government, you're going to really hate world government.
No.
That's what it would take if we hit some tipping points with the warming of the atmosphere. I mean, for example, you may recall last week we had a record temperature in the Arctic, the highest in recorded history since 1885. It was over 100 degrees in Siberia, higher than the record temperature for Miami.
Mm-hmm.
And the last decade was by far the hottest decade on record and so forth. There appeared to be for a while a pause in the cooling about 15 years ago, but it seems to be accelerating now. And there are a lot of feedback loops involved here that if this continues, well, it's difficult. And reducing carbon emissions is one thing. There's other things that you can do. Worst case, everything fails. It's hard to coordinate. Countries don't cooperate. The cool Earth strategy, George, is radical, but in theory it would work. And that is simply move the Earth-Moon system a little farther out away from the sun. Just kind of turn the dial to the right to cool it. Just like if there were an ice age, you could, in theory, move it a little farther back. The trouble is, as we say, fuzz implies chaos.
Mm-hmm.
That works in theory, works on average, but like the proverbial statistician who drowned in a lake that was only 12 inches deep on average, a lot can go wrong. And in the novel, somebody gets the crazy idea to move it back, and it's pretty much the end of the world as we know it, and that's what the real-time drama is concerned with. It's completely fact-based, intensive research, both in terms of the physics involved with that, as well as a lot of the artificial intelligence and other aspects of what society will, the best I could estimate, look like, at least from a tech view, in a few decades.
And when you say move it back, do you mean nudge it back out of its orbit?
Well, like that. You can imagine kind of a finger of God interceding. It's really what Newton had in mind when he first saw the universality of gravity. He asked the question, is the solar system stable? Because it actually is not. Long term, it's chaotic. I wouldn't freak out. But he thought that maybe periodically God needed to come by and kind of set the planets back in their path. His rival Leibniz have nothing to do with that. No, the trick revealed at the end of the novel is to use the trick that we use with space probes and to steal, in effect, angular momentum from large planets. So if you remember the Viking launches back from the 70s,
right.
What we did to propel them is called a gravity catapult. We stole some of the angular momentum, for example, of Jupiter, and that speeded up the probe. We do mm-hmm. that all the time. Now, it's not a free launch, George. It's literally conserved, so it's a zero-sum game. That means we've slowed the orbit, or rotation at least, of Jupiter maybe by a meter and several million years. And if you went in the other direction with the probe, you could actually transfer a little tiny bit of angular momentum from the probe to Jupiter. All right, now imagine doing that with a large asteroid instead of a probe, and not around Jupiter but around the moon, and you could transfer, in theory, you could transfer a lot of the angular momentum called reverse gravity slingshot around the moon, and you would gently energize and move that Earth-Moon system a little farther out from the sun. Because the Earth and Moon are very close compared to the sun.
Sure.
And you do that repeatedly. In theory, you could do that and move it out or in the other direction, move it back.
If you miscalculate, you're in trouble.
Well, you're in big trouble. I say fuzz implies chaos. And by that, I mean the classic sense of fuzzy logic, that we may think things are black and white, but they're really shades of gray. And to get this kind of thing right, you've got to get it right, George, to many, many decimal places. And even our best quantum measurements really can't do that. Maybe 10, 15 decimal places. If you don't get a feedback system like this right to several decimal places, then since they're very nonlinear, this is not just a three-body problem. It's really a multi-body problem, an unsolved mathematical problem. You're going to get chaos. And so small changes in initial conditions can compound, and sometimes very quickly, and lead to what appear to be random effects. So that's exactly the issue here. And like I say in the novel, somebody gets the idea, some environmentalists, to try to move things back. Because, again, it works on average. You may lower the temperature of the planet, the atmosphere, maybe a couple degrees Celsius. But a lot can go wrong. You could crack the Hoover Dam and freeze Europe and the like, and moving it back turns out to be even more catastrophic.
And you dedicate your book to the late Sir Arthur C. Clarke because of some of his work that he did.
He helped with a short story that I published many years ago called Cool Earth. And what had happened is I published a book, you may remember many years ago, called Fuzzy Thinking about fuzzy logic. It was a big hit. It's a nonfiction book. Arthur read it, got to know him from a friend, and we became fax pals in those days, later email pals. And actually, I was going to work on a book with him once. And when I told him I had a short story coming out, he wanted to see it. And the reason in particular was I had critiqued one of his Rama novels. And it's a good sequence of novels, but the result, you find out that the universe is a simulation being run by a godlike figure looking for harmonious universe.
Hold on for a second, Bart. We're at a break, but we'll come back and pick it up right here. Dr. Bart Kosko with us. His latest work is called Cool Earth. Next hour, we'll take your calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We're back with Dr. Bart Kosko. His book, Cool Earth, his website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Bart, let's get back to the Arthur C. Clarke story. So you two started conversing, and what was that like?
What happened, George? Well, it was a lot of fun. I mean, Arthur was a great mind. I think one of the pioneers, grandmasters of certainly science fiction, but I think fiction more generally, and hard science fiction, George, not fantasy stuff. And, of course, the great example is the story Sentinel, which became 2001 A Space Odyssey.
That's right.
A lot of other stuff. And part of that was this great sequence of novels, which everyone should read, called the Rama novels. And you find out at the end of all these novels that the purpose of the universe is to, that we're in a simulation and a godlike figure is running simulations looking for harmonious universe seeds. And then comes the big mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And Arthur, like me, obsessed with not making technical mistakes, said this godlike figure says, I'm looking for a closed, dense set of universe seeds. Well, that's mathematically trivial. And he meant open, dense set. I couldn't resist pointing that out to Arthur. And there it was. I mean, it's an extremely fine point of splitting mathematical hairs. He was not trained in topology, and so it's not his fault. So when I told him that I also published fiction, I had a short story coming out in a magazine where Ray Bradbury had gone first. It was a men's magazine. And then after Ray Bradbury, it was Harlan Ellison, then me. And he said, I got to see it. And so, wow, you know, so he wanted to see the galley proofs, and I faxed him the galley proofs. Remember, he lived in Sri Lanka.
That's right.
In Colombo,
right.
Sri Lanka. And Arthur came right back. He liked the story, liked the writing, and he caught a big hole. And he really dressed this professor down. I remember he said, take a seat in the back of the class. He just gave a total payback and totally justified. And what do you do, George, when you got Arthur C. Clarke catching a big hole in a science fiction story? It's Cool Earth coming out, already typeset. In those days, it was magazines, so it was very complicated to change it. Well, you take it to the editor, who happened to be a big fan of Sir Arthur, and you say, look, I got to be able to fix it. And I was able to come up, got real creative, and fixed the problem. It was in the background. I was all caught up in the characters and the story, but it was a real problem, and that made a huge difference. And you fix the story, but I then had a chance over the following years, really decades, you think about it, you hike about it, the characters collide in your mind's eye, and it grew into this current effort, the complete drama of Cool Earth, which, by the way, is what we call a real-time drama. You don't see a lot of those. So if there were a film, and I must say that there is a lot of Hollywood interest in this, if there's a film, the 120 minutes or so of the film or the 120 minutes of the story, like, and so there's very few cases. In the Kubrick case, that was with Dr. Strangelove, or High Noon was a case, Hitchcock's Rope, more recently the movie Gravity. So it's a real-time thriller that's taken many years to evolve, and it's not for the squeamish. It is the end of the world as we know it.
Well, and you gave us 60 years out of it. You gave us to 2080 to get this thing, to get our act together.
You got till 2080. There's a lot of simple steps we can take now, and it's unclear whether we're going to do it. It looks like the warming, which had slowed, is definitely speeding up. Again, just in the last year, the last 10 years was the hottest decade on record. 2019 was the second hottest year on record. 2016 was the hottest year on record. The measurements, George, are getting more accurate. So whatever the politics, and it's ugly, of global warming, let's call it what it is, it's warming, not just climate change. You can change up or down. We're changing up on average. The laws of large numbers, as we call them in statistics, are converging more and more in the simulations as more data come around. We just know a lot more about this than we did even 10 years ago. And the trend is up, appears to be accelerating. And there are certain tipping points, including the melting of the Arctic ice. Now, the Arctic is warming about three times faster than the rest of the atmosphere. And that opens up a lot of possibilities for cooling strategies. which not everybody's on board with. But that's one possibility here. The other thing is, as you warm up in the Arctic and the Antarctic, you begin to thaw the permafrost. That's a very big deal because you have about twice as much carbon that's in the atmosphere now frozen in the permafrost. But worse, you begin to release methane. I think there was a show last year came out called Fire on Ice or The Ice on Fire. And you're finding this in Siberia. They have sinkholes and other places. When you release methane into the atmosphere, that is a much more potent greenhouse gas than is carbon dioxide. And you're going to get accelerations. When you melt the Arctic ice, there's nothing but dark water beneath it. That warms it up versus the Antarctic, which has land beneath it, and so forth. So what can you do? Well, one thing you can do is have a carbon tax. I think most economists agree with that. We are creating what the economists call a negative externality, the sort of thing you do when you pollute. But this pollution stays up in the atmosphere potentially for 100 or so years. A lot of it enters the ocean. We're acidifying the ocean. They're warming. It's real tough to cool that. And we're free-riding, countries free-riding on one another. China's by far the biggest polluter. We're second. We've been reducing emissions, actually. But we still don't have a rational pricing of carbon. And then we're all free riding on future generations. So it's a really vexatious problem, George. It's like the COVID is a kind of run up to it to see how we deal with this and the other pandemics. Can we coordinate? We're not coordinating real well.
Not this
so
one.
Far, but it's, you know, it'd be a lot tougher in the case of warming. The other thing we can do is keep all the options on the table, and that includes nuclear energy. Now, there's been a lot of problems with that, the older uranium reactors. And a lot of scare movies like the China Syndrome, but nuclear is a long-term renewable, reasonably safe. I know it's got problems in the waste products, but we've been addressing that, and that's the uranium nuclear reactors. That's not the new thorium reactors that are underway in development in China and India, for example. It's interesting, if you remember the Democrat candidate, Andrew Yang, and he proposed, which is, I think, at odds with much of his party, investing $50 billion in research on thorium reactors to jumpstart that. The thorium fuel cycle, thorium is 90 on the periodic table, uranium is 92, is much safer. There's a lot more thorium. You don't have the kind of meltdown risk. The bomb potential is a lot less because it ends up not with plutonium-239 like our current reactors do, but rather with uranium-233 and right down the line. But it'll take, there's a lot of engineering to be done. And just improving, using the newer models of uranium reactors are out there. And finally, George, cooling experiments, what's known as geoengineering. Now, not something as radical as moving the Earth-Moon system like in cool Earth. That's the absolute worst case. Hopefully we'll never get there. But there's a lot of things you could do. Local experiments here in California or the Mojave Desert with putting sulfates in the air, what's sometimes called a designer volcano, and maybe going to the poles, especially the Arctic, to do a little bit of that. It is a form of pollution. It can have some acid rain effects. It won't affect the acidification of the ocean, but it will buy time. And it's, I think, a prudent thing to at least be developing it. Right now, there's largely a moratorium on geoengineering. But if the acceleration increases, I think that has to be a rational item on the table. And my bigger point, George, from an engineering point of view, every engineering option has to be on the table. You can't have ideology limiting these things. The ideology can help put it, the issue front and center, but this is going to be a vexing problem, a long-term generational problem. And again, and the incentive is just to punt it, just to kick it downstream, but we may not have that luxury. So relatively inexpensively, a few billion dollars a year, it looks like, if all goes well, you could spray almost like in a garden hose. This is even in the book Freakonomics years ago, by the way. You could spray some sulfur aerosols, especially, say, over the Arctic, and different simulations have come up with different results. But if you could veil or shade that about 25% from the sun,
that's a dramatic change.
You could restore a lot of the temperatures.
You sure can. What is Google in your eye that you talk about in the book?
We're going to keep shrinking down these search engines, George. And right now you're using your fingers, and then you can have the touchpad. And increasingly, that's going to be where you, quote, will it, a sense of will. But where are you going to store that? I think it inevitably goes in your retina. There's a blind spot in your retina. There's a way to do it. And it's fairly easy to energize.
Really? Without disrupting our vision?
That'll be, I mean, it'll take some work. But I think you can have it in there and using some distributed, parallel distributed, in effect, screen, heads-up type of screens. The other thing is, as we increase the interface with the brain and the chip, everyone's working on this around the world, maybe that internal picture can be done differently. But I think you can have it there. The other thing is the energy source can be in different places. You can get solar energy from it, and you could also have backup. For example, on your arm, you might have a backup hard drive. But a lot of what you have on your computer, I think that's going in you at some point, and quite likely in our lifetime here. And once that starts happening, I don't think there's any turning back to it.
When you were putting this together, I mean, this was based on years and years of your experience with all your other works. Was it difficult or was it easy to come up with the scenario, the book?
You know, the scenario I thought of years ago, and it really worked out the story while skiing one night looking at the moon, because the moon gets cracked in the, at the end of the book. But these other technology aspects have, as you suggest, really come out of my published results, and everyone's welcome to view them. I just posted another paper on my webpage. It just will appear in the Journal of Neural Networks in September, which I think, in terms of the mathematical theorems in the appendix, are the current state of the art, at least for a week or two, in that field. But I had a chance to think about a lot of things in those regards, George, and including efforts on patenting with USC and working with my colleagues. I think I have a pretty good feel for where the literature is. Like, I have a series of papers coming out at conference, AI conferences next month. Well, now we're in July, but July and in August. And as a consequence, you get a sense of what's doable and what's not doable and how these things can go wrong, and maybe really terribly wrong.
This is one of those years, Bart, people just want to go away.
It's been a tough one, and it may get tougher still. And then to have a very contentious election on top of it, it's a year to remember.
Absolutely. With everything you've been writing about over the years, what got you into this area? You must have seen something, whether you looked into a crystal ball or what. But, I mean, you have been able to put your thumb on a lot of futuristic things that have come true. How'd you see these things?
A lot of what I did, George, was teaching. So the best way to understand a subject is teach it. And we often tell students, just try to explain what you learned today or you think you learned today to your roommate or someone else. So there's that aspect. The more you teach, for example, what's known as Maxwell's equations, the four equations that completely describe electricity and magnetism, and that lead to modern quantum theory and general relativity in some sense, and many, many other things. You just get a deeper feel for that, and once it's embedded in your synapses, you start to create with it. You see a problem, you think of different solutions. And as a professor, I think we get to focus on those kind of abstractions in a paid way, and much more than the average person does, and more so than the average person does in a laboratory. And that's where it's largely come from. But, you know, George, I actually started out writing music. I was a scholarship student to USC on a music scholarship writing film music. And to me, that was one of the hardest things I ever did, to come up with something new. As tough as...
Oh, my God,
as that was, and as tough as mathematics, and mathematics is just a language. But to come up with a new theme, new chord progression, it's very tough. And it's just a discipline of creativity. The other thing you learn from doing that, George, you know whether you got a big result or a little result. I used to write a lot of classical music, and so I'd get a result, say, well, maybe this is good enough for a violin and piano sonata. This something bigger, this really warrants a string quartet, which I did a lot of as a kid. And or this one is so good that it's big enough you could build a symphony on it.
Right.
And I did as a kid. And so you get the same sense with science. I'm very hesitant to publish. And I usually don't do it unless I consider at least one major mathematical theorem, and I go over it, and it just grows in time. I take a long time to bring results. Or the book Cool Earth, it really took years of development. I write it, set it aside, and come back. And part of that, for example, I just published a paper since I last talked to you. It came out in November on quantum annealing. Now, this is a powerful way to search bumpy surfaces of cost, trying to find a low-cost solution. For certain surfaces, it's the fastest known way. And some people have called this super AI or AI supremacy, if we can achieve that. But one of the applications of this would be searching genomes at minimum, trying to come up with versions, say, of your genes that have a much lower chance of getting cancer. But once you open that door, George, once you, you turn loose the powers of still Moore's Law to some degree, the ever-great exponential powers of computers to search your genomes, you're going to do a lot more than worry about your health. You're going to worry about how you look and the like. And the novel Cool Earth explores that. So, for example, if you want to make a child, well, we have a way of doing that now, let's say you and your wife or your spouse, and that child is a kind of statistical average. Of course, there's many other averages that are known as brothers and sisters. Once you found that average as a kind of dot in what we call genome space, we can then do random searches around that dot, and we can constrain those searches by what we want. We want a healthy child. We want to reduce
You could manipulate that. Bart, hang with us. We're at the top of the hour. We'll come back for more and phone calls with Dr. Bart Costco, Cool Earth.